Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast with your host, Andrew Keel. This is the podcast where you can get the education you need to invest 100% passively in the highly profitable niche of mobile home parks.
Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Keel, and today we have an exciting episode planned for you with two special guests in Mr. Patrick McDonald and Nick Cibula, co-founders of CMG Parks. Patrick and Nick have built an impressive portfolio in the mobile home park space, owning and operating 30 mobile home and RV parks across six states and serving nearly 2,000 residents. With backgrounds in medical sales management and financial planning, these Washington State University alums combined their expertise to create a specialized real estate investment firm focused on value-add mobile home park opportunities. Welcome to the show, Patrick and Nick.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, excited to be here. Thanks, Andrew.
Yeah, no, I'm excited. We connected on LinkedIn and excited to learn more about your story. Maybe you can start there and just kind of tell us a little bit about yourselves, how in the world you got into mobile home park investing.
Yeah, you go ahead.
Yeah, so Patrick and myself, we met in college through mutual friends. At the time, about 6 years ago, we were working our corporate positions. I was in medical sales as a regional manager, and Patrick was in financial planning. And we knew we just wanted to kind of passively invest in, multifamily real estate, or just real estate in general in the Puget Sound area where we were living at the time. We purchased a couple duplexes and small multifamily, and we were looking for our next purchase and stumbled upon a small mobile home park, 13 spaces, that was about 5 minutes from where we were both living at the time. Did a little research, and the more we looked into, the more positive things we found and advantages. The returns on it kind of blew anything that we had looked at out of the water. So we went ahead with that purchase and kind of cut our teeth just by doing everything on site for those first 6 months. And within, I think, like I said, that those first 3 to 6 months, we kind of knew that's where we wanted our business to go. So we started looking at selling off the small multifamily and the duplexes, and rolled that into, what was the second purchase? Montana?
We found a park on Craigslist out in Great Falls, Montana. Yeah, Craigslist. I think it was back when you could still find deals on Craigslist. I don't think that exists anymore, but.
Yeah.
Dude, that's amazing.
Yeah, we just kind of started selling off all the other stuff and rolling it into parks, and had a couple of home runs that sold within like the first 18 months of us buying them. And then, just kind of snowballed into what it is today.
Wow. And when was that first park? You said that was about how long ago?
That was like 2017 when we purchased that one.
2017. So same as me. I bought my first park in June 2017. You know, I'm curious, from when you like found that first 13 lot park to like going all in and like deciding, hey, this is it. You know, what was that time frame? Because like for me, it was like, all right, in 2015, I think I was like, all right, I want to buy a mobile home park. And then it took all the way to 2017 to kind of like get organized and kind of get ready to do that.
Yeah. I can't remember the exact stats. We both quit our corporate jobs like March 2020 and went full time. So I think
right when COVID, like COVID.
Yeah, right
time.
At COVID. Yeah. It was perfect timing, actually. Actually, I think Nick milked his job for like 8 months.
Yeah, technically I was on furlough. I was on furlough at the time. Not a lot of medical procedures that were happening, but it kind of helped kickstart and give us that kick to essentially, you know, go full time. And I think once we did and we both committed to it full time, within like the first 3 months, I think we had six or seven parks under contract. So it just grew tremendously.
I'm curious, you know, at what level did you feel comfortable like leaving your jobs? Like, was it a certain number of lots? Was it a certain amount of cash flow? You know, what was the deciding factor there?
I don't think we felt comfortable leaving our corporate jobs, but I remember thinking like we both didn't like our corporate jobs anymore. So it was good timing. You know, both of our wives work. So a lot of hats off to them for kind of floating us for the first year or so. But yeah, we had eight parks that were cash flowing okay. I mean, it definitely was not replacing our corporate income, but the combination of like having that cash flow, having a spouse that worked, and frankly, not like living outside our means, right, allowed us to kind of take a step back for a year or two and then kind of get to where we are today. So
We just became best friends. No, like, can we just pause for a minute and talk about spouses that work and kind of help support the bill? That's exactly how I did it with my wife. Like, literally, she kind of had the consistent income and I was out there just kind of rolling the dice on this trailer park thing, you know, that my dad was like, hey, you probably shouldn't do that, Andrew. You know, you went to college. You don't need to be doing that.
Yeah.
And here we are, right? It worked out. So hats off to your wives for doing that and allowing you guys to do it.
Right?
Hey, I'm telling you, you know, you guys are onto something with this mobile home park thing. So that's really cool. Patrick, let me ask you first this one. If you had to do it all over again, what would you do differently?
Do it sooner, right? That's everybody's answer. You know, I think quitting our job sooner, definitely I would have done if I had to do it over again. Obviously, it's scary to let go of a paycheck and jump into something. But I think after we did it, we never looked back. And like Nick said, we had 6 or 7 parks under contract in that first like 6 months. And so it just kind of took the free time that we needed in order to expand. And so do it sooner, have faith in the process, and just kind of take the leap, really.
Love that. Nick, same question. You know, if you had to do it all over again, what would you do differently?
Yeah, everyone says buy more, right? Like we wish we would have, you know, gone a whole lot more in, you know, 5, 6 years ago. But I think maybe scale larger, quicker too. You know, we didn't know what we didn't know. And so we started with 13 and then we moved to 25 and then we went to 50 and then we went 150 space RV. And that was kind of our scale. But we were at the time doing it with friends and family capital. So maybe like move to outside partnerships and private equity and try to scale a lot larger, quicker.
That's good.
Yeah, just to add to that, I do think it was scary moving from like 13 spaces, even to like 50 and then up to 150, right? But when you look back, it's almost the same amount of work. So it's like, you might as well just do the 150 from the get-go versus trying to, you know, piece together 50 pad parks.
Totally. Did you guys go to like the Frank and Dave boot camp or how did you get educated like before you bought, you know, your first couple of parks?
Yeah, I mean, I think we did a lot of, I can't remember the forum. It was like Mobile Home Park Forum or something. We did a lot of reading on there. We, of course, went to Frank and Dave. I think everybody goes to that and should go to that. That's a good, like, you know, mobile home park investing 101. And so we did do that. And then a lot of it, the benefit of having this, our first park being 13 spaces and so close to both Nick and I was that we were on site, you know, once or twice or three times a week, actually doing the property management, digging the ditches, understanding how sewer and water lines work in parks. And so just getting that exposure from like doing it was very helpful.
That's awesome. And then, you know, tell me about that lot, that 13 lot park. Was that like a value add deal? Were you infilling, you know, sub metering? Was it that type of project or was it pretty stabilized? And then, you know, what are the projects you're looking at now? Are you looking at, you know, value add 150 lots that needs a bunch of infill or what's your buy box like now?
Yeah, I wouldn't really label it value add as much as some of the projects that we've taken on since then. 13 spaces, I think there was one vacant home that had actually been previously sold to our purchase, and they were going to be remodeling it. But really, metering back and then rents below market. So not too heavy of a lift. But since then, we've done a little bit of everything. We've done infill projects. We've taken on, you know, the 2-star dilapidated communities with a bunch of junk. We've taken on, you know, portfolios that have 100+ park owned homes in them. So we've done a little bit of everything. And I don't think there's necessarily anything that we're afraid to take on at this point.
No. Yeah. I think private utilities, right? We've had to replace full septic systems. We've had to replumb, you know, countless linear feet of water lines and things like that. I think where we're at today, of course, we all would want that, you know, 100+ pad park that all you have to do is raise rents. The reality is you don't come across those very often. So our sweet spot is kind of some level of infill and divesting of park owned homes. That's kind of like our sweet spot. We have a really good sales team and that helps.
And tell us about that, because that's one area that I personally have struggled is with buying fully park owned home parks and converting them, you know, and kind of how do you pro forma like that to go, right? Because some people don't want to do an RTO type of arrangement. Some people prefer to rent. So yeah, what kind of tactics or strategies have you used to do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first question or thing you have to look at in a park that has a ton of park-owned homes is the quality and age. Mm. Anything pre-HUD is difficult to sell. Well, you can't really sell with a loan, right? You can't go out and use 21st Mortgage or Triad to sell that. So you are using RTO in that strategy or cash. So that's the first thing we always look at. Obviously, we want kind of like newer 80s, 90s builds that have the pitched roof. That's ideal for park-owned homes. The biggest thing in having a large portfolio of park-owned homes is having a good contractor, right? Somebody that can actually flip these homes and get them ready. As much as we want to sell to the residents that are already renting those homes, that happens like 20 or 25% of the time. So a lot of times it's giving notice, getting the renter out, remodeling the home, putting it on market and selling it. And we've learned a very tough lesson over the years on spending too much on remodels or using a bad contractor. And that can really put you in the hole. So really going in kind of eyes open on what things are actually going to cost. You can get into the nitty gritty on like the type of siding homes have and things like that, but it's really just understanding what each home on average may cost and what you could sell it for.
It's also being conscious of the market too. So if you're going in and you're knowing that there's a large portfolio of park-owned homes that you need to divest from, you've got to feel pretty good about that market and the demand. And not just the demand, you know, in that market, but also for the specific product that you're selling. So if it's, you know, if it's a large amount of older two bedrooms, it's going to be much more difficult than, like Patrick said, the 80s, 90s, and making sure that you have a three bedroom homes for all age communities.
That's huge, Nick. Yeah. And that's something that I think I even have overlooked is understanding the difference between the number of bedrooms that a home has and how such a big difference it is from the demand for a three bedroom to a two bedroom or a one bedroom. It's just such a steep drop off. So yeah, that's a very good point. Good job.
Yeah. And that's not something that we just look at for divesting of park owned homes, but also for infill, right? When we first got started, you know, maybe we were a little naive on the two versus three, but nowadays, you know, we pay very close attention to the size of these lots and making sure that not only is there space to get a three bedroom, but that there's also ample parking room too.
Yeah, that's smart. What do you think has been the toughest hurdle that you guys have overcome to get to this point, right? You're right around 2,000 lots. You know, tell me about that process and kind of what was the hardest part about getting to this spot?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think every person you interview that's an operator has a similar sentiment to property management, right? Is that we all started this thinking it was going to be a little bit more passive than it is. And the reality is, you know, a lot of our time is spent growing a property management company. And so I think that has been our biggest hurdle back then and continues to be our biggest hurdle today is just scaling that and making that at least semi-profitable so that you can kind of keep the lights and doors open, right? And so a lot of our time goes into, I mean, Nick and I still, I mean, we're a pretty lean team in general, but we're still doing a decent amount of property management and helping the team out in that regard. So just the whole kind of property management ownership and growing that kind of piece of the business has been a challenge and could, I think will always be a challenge.
Yeah. What does your operation look like now? You know, your property management company, because you guys are vertically integrated, right? You have your own.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have about 10 corporate employees here in Seattle that work in our office. And then we leverage virtual assistants. I think that's huge. That's become a bigger piece for us for low end, like bookkeeping tasks and property management tasks like lease renewals and things like that. And so we have four of those folks. And then of course we have probably 40 or so people boots on the ground that are at the parks, people from kind of, I would call them regional managers that manage multiple parks to area managers that maybe only have one or two parks to park managers to helpers. And so all together, we probably have like 50 or 55 employees at some level.
Very nice. And your portfolio, have you guys sold anything or you still own, you know, some of those early on parks in addition to the new stuff?
Yeah, we're starting to get rid of some of our smaller stuff at this point that was purchased like early to 2020, 21. Mm-hmm. I think to date we've sold 4 communities, so not a lot. Our most recent was actually this last December.
Nice, nice.
Yeah, we still own the 13 pad park. It's kind of down the street from us still and our baby. So
We like to use it as like a for people that come and visit when we do trainings for new managers in our corporate office.
Oh, nice.
Because it is 5 minutes down the street. We can just run down the street and kind of walk around with them and point things out and use it as
totally.
a bit of a training.
That's awesome. Yeah, very cool. And yeah, tell us about the portfolio, like where it's located, the different states you're in, the size of the communities, which are RV, which are MH,
yeah,
if you don't mind.
Yeah, so we have about 30 communities in total, 20 to 22 are MHP, the other 8 or so are RV. We do primarily extended stay RV parks. We do have one transient kind of resort style park out in Montana, which we could get into, but it's really not our favorite thing. That's more of a hospitality play and that's something that we've learned after buying it. But we're primarily in Washington. We just recently bought a park in Oregon. We're in California, we're in Montana, Idaho, and North Dakota. Like Nick mentioned earlier, in the beginning, we kind of used a shotgun approach to buying parks, right? Like any park we can buy, we'll do it. It didn't matter where it was. Now we're a little bit more strategic on where we purchase parks. They either need to be around existing portfolio or at least have scale in a new location to make it worth it. North Dakota is a good example of a state we went into last year, but that had 400 pads. So it made kind of going to North Dakota worthwhile. But yeah, I think we're just chasing bigger deals at this point of our career. You know, like I said earlier, the 50 pad park is the same work as the 200 pad park. So it just kind of makes sense.
Yeah, no, that's good. And how do you guys find these deals?
Yeah, we do a little bit of everything. So obviously creating relationships over the last few years with the brokers in our regions has paid off dividends. We do a lot of direct marketing. So we have campaigns that kind of hit on all aspects, whether it's postcards, ringless voicemails, emails, texts. You know, we both have a little bit of a sales background. So that part, I don't think will ever go away where we're talking directly to park owners. But for the lot larger, maybe more desirable properties, it's always going to be much more competitive. So that really plays an important role to having those relationships with those brokers.
Yeah, we're still sending out postcards with like our family photo on it, you know, so that we can kind of pull the heartstrings of some of these older mom and pop owners.
That's fantastic. Yeah. And do you guys get some calls off of those? Like, has it been, you know, pretty successful?
Yeah. I mean, today, I would say more than half of the properties we purchase have been direct from owner
nice.
Off market. So, yeah. Now, granted, as I said, that's becoming maybe a little bit less now as we're focusing on the larger portfolios and communities.
Sure.
But we'll still continue to do it for sure.
That's fantastic. And tell me about, you know, the strategy, the Pacific Northwest, you know, notoriously known for kind of having some blue state landlord tenant laws and things like that, and how you guys get comfortable with that and kind of what, you know, what role rent control has in your, you know, kind of, you know, just kind of dashboard, kind of what you're looking at and so forth.
Yeah. I mean, we're not naive that, you know, rent control is not in Washington yet. It's very close to being in Washington. For the last few years, it's been a hot topic and almost gotten passed. And so for the last few years, we've underwritten to some level of rent control. You know, our neighbors to the south in Oregon have statewide rent control at 10, basically, well, it's 10%, but it's 7% plus CPI. And so we've kind of underwrote to that level of rent control here in Washington. I would say we've transitioned not away from Washington, but we're looking at other places outside the Pacific Northwest more and more because of kind of what's happening here locally. There's a pretty good chance that rent control passes in 2025 in Washington. And you combine that with already pretty tough landlord-tenant law in terms of evictions and things like that. It makes the state a little bit less desirable for us to invest in, which is unfortunate because we live here. And part of the reason why we got into this business is kind of the mission of affordable housing. And, you know, it's frustrating to kind of see the people in power just be naive to what rent control can do to communities. So it's not to say that we're not going to invest in Washington, but we're very strategic and we underwrite to that kind of rent control number.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think a big part of it is just knowing, right? Knowing ahead of time what that is. And I think what surprised me, like we bought a park in New York a couple years ago. And, you know, we underwrote the expected rent control and the rent increases that we could do. but just the pushback on evictions and the pushback on just other regulations, from getting an operating license to, you know, just getting the power turned on, just all of these additional, you know, requirements and permits and things that were needed, just make it way less friendly to do business there, you know? So I'm sure it's similar, you know, where you guys are at, but yeah, I think your strategy makes sense. And North Dakota, I own in North Dakota. Is that in Bismarck?
Yes.
Yeah. That's what we talked about. Yeah. On LinkedIn, I think I saw you guys. So yeah, we own there. Hopefully the population increase keeps booming in Bismarck.
Well, that's where we have over 100 park owned homes there. So it's been fun. But I mean, I think today, in less than a year, we've sold 30 plus homes there. So it's going well.
That's great. Wow. That's awesome. And you're using like 21st Mortgage and some of these other like chattel lenders to, you know, get cashed out of those sales.
Yeah. I mean, one of the other avenues that we do when we go into a market is typically it's credit unions, right? But reach out to the credit unions that lend on manufactured homes. And for whatever reason, Bismarck has 4 or 5 locally. So it's been kind of a blessing out there to find lending.
Wow. That'll finance your tenants to buy the homes that you're selling in the park.
Yeah. 21st is probably the best option. And the one reason is that they use past rent payments for a down payment. That's typically residents' biggest hurdle to purchasing, is coming up with 5 or 10% down. So having the ability to use past rent payments has been huge for us out there.
That's awesome. Well, you're going to have to send over those listed credit unions, because I think I could utilize some of those. So
yeah, you bet.
That'd be awesome. Sure. Well, yeah. Tell us about your most recent acquisition, what that looked like. And obviously with higher interest rates, it's been a little bit tougher to get deals done. So how did you guys pivot around that and get the deal done?
Yeah, our most recent was actually an extended stay RV park in Oregon, our first community out in that state. This started probably close to 8 to 9 months ago when we first started communicating with the owner through a broker. So it was listed off market. Beautiful park, super clean, 120 lots. They did it's like more of a hybrid where they were doing a mix of transient and extended stay, but a lot of contractors. There's a lot of data centers that are going on in this area in Oregon. But like you said, interest rate environment is obviously had changed quite a bit. And then just looking at you know, the rates and where things are coming in at, we did have that essentially that conversation that led to owner Carrie. So after a couple months of kind of going back and forth with that, they committed and to doing favorable terms on an owner Carrie. And we were able to get that to the finish line here in December. So things are going well right now. And yeah, that was our last purchase.
Yeah. And I would say from the beginning, somebody told us to always create two offers when you're making an offer on a property, one kind of the cash out with a loan and the other doing a seller financing. And obviously there's tremendous benefits to a seller if they don't have anything that they're going to roll it into to do seller financing. So we've always kind of had our offers have two different scenarios in it. The last 18 months, that scenario has become more prevalent, right? Like people are picking that seller financing to kind of get the number that they had in their mind versus the number they could get if we were to use traditional financing. So in fact, the last two parks that we bought, both in December, were seller financing parks, and at favorable terms, like 4% interest only for 3 or 4 or 5 years with, you know, 20 or 25% down. So we've learned to kind of have those conversations with the seller and kind of manage expectations when we offer on parks.
Super smart. Yeah, I love that. I love that strategy. And did either of you do any sort of like wholesaling or single family home flipping or have any sort of background in that before you
got... Not single family, no, but just through our direct to owner marketing, we've come across a fair amount of deals that had a lot of meat on the bone and were pretty strong. So we've done a few wholesales of mobile home parks here and there in the last 6 months to a year. That's tailed off as we've kind of scaled. But before getting into parks, we hadn't done any flips or any wholesaling, but just naturally through finding some good deals, we've done a couple of those in the past.
That's awesome. Yeah, I guess, what do you think is the best strategy right now? Like what's, you know, moving forward, what are the type of mobile home parks you're looking to buy? And, you know, based on what you've learned, you know, from that 13 lot mobile home park all the way to now, and kind of what does that ideal, perfect mobile home park look like?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the environment has gotten tougher, both from higher interest rates and just manufactured housing in general being kind of the new shiny toy that private equity and institutional capital want to play with. So we're definitely seeing, I would say, less deals overall, or less attractive deals maybe than we were a few years back. You know, we've kind of got to a point where we are looking for the bigger, at least 100 plus, ideally 200 plus lot parks. We did take on private equity last year, which has kind of opened our buy box to go after bigger deals. And so that's something that we're really driving towards is buying these bigger deals. And Bismarck's a good example of, you know, 400 lots that we bought out there with private equity dollars. Now, we're still kind of value add, right? We're still looking for the park-owned homes. We're still looking for the infill. We're still looking for the parks maybe an established or REIT may not buy. So the value add's still there, but we're definitely looking for bigger. We're not really interested in like the 30 pad park anymore.
Very cool. And tell me about that. Like, how did you get connected with a private equity firm? And you know, before then you were just using mom and pop, or you were using like friends and family money, right? Like that was just kind of just internally how you were purchasing stuff.
Yeah. I mean, we've done a little bit, you know, in the beginning, it was just Nick and I's money that we kind of saved up, and that only went so far. I think that went to three or four parks. Then we got connected with a good buddy of ours that did multifamily syndication. And he's like, hey, our investors would like some current cash flow. And so we did a few, like four or five parks with him. And that kind of taught us the rope of syndication. And then we kind of moved on to friends and family dollars. And that's great. But, you know, that's probably what keeps us up at night the most is like managing parks that are friends and family owned, because that makes Christmas and, you know, get togethers weird when they aren't going well. So a couple of years ago, we knew we were never going to be the Brandon Turner, right? That can go out and get like $100 million from retail investors. And so we were trying to think, okay, where do we go next? And we started to look into institutional and private equity capital. And so we just started having meetings. It was a good time because we weren't as big as we are now, but we had probably, you know, 18 or 20 parks. So we had done a couple of turnarounds. We had done some full cycle parks. And so we had a bit of a track record that at least got our foot in the door with private equity. And it probably took 12 to 18 months of just kind of sending deals to multiple private equity shops, talking to them, letting them understand how we underwrite deals, how we look at things. And then one finally kind of hit, and that was Bismarck out in North Dakota. And that's our only one. We would love to do more, but you know, they, depending on the private equity shop, they have, you know, different buy boxes that they need to kind of hit in their fund. So it's sure. Challenging in that aspect is finding the right fit for the right shop.
And timing around that as well, making sure it's at a point where they're actually, you know, putting out capital.
Yeah, some private equities are raising, some are deploying, some are on hold. So it just kind of depends.
Very cool. Well, kudos to you guys, you know, because I know there's extensive like background they have to run on you, and, you know, you have to have the right track record and so forth. So
they didn't look at our high school and college days, I don't think so.
Yeah. What mistakes in mobile home park investing or operations have you guys made that, you know, our listeners can learn from?
I think, as I mentioned earlier, we were a little naive on the 2 versus 3 bedroom and size of lots when we first purchased like communities that needed infill. Maybe a little naive on specific markets too, where you needed to either sell park-owned homes or sell new homes. Looking back on a few of our purchases, they just require a lot more hands-on and more time. I guess we're a little more conscious now of how heavy of lift a project is. You know, when you have a handful of parks and three of them are stabilized, you can really focus on one or two, you know, versus now where you've got 30 plus communities and you're doing infill and some level at all of them. So yeah, purchasing like, you know, the 2-star park that needs new roads and new utilities and infill and just kind of all of the above, we may turn those away now.
Yeah, I think the lower hanging fruit, right? There's lower hanging fruit elsewhere that can get you those returns without so many man hours of, you know, construction work. So I totally agree. And it's hard though, because, you know, like my post, Patrick, that you mentioned on LinkedIn, you find these deals, but they have like literally 5,000 tires. This right. It's a small mobile home park, but it's in like a great area. Like the median home price is over $500,000. And I think it's only like 18 lots, but there's literally like 5,000 tires on the property and it's just completely abandoned. And anyways, but I was like, you know what? I'm sure I can clean this up. But then you dig into it and you're like, wow, this is such a mess. You know,
it's a lot of
work,
right?
It's a lot of work, right? When you could buy that 50 lot park that's full and just, you know, raise rents $30 a year, you know, and do just as well, right? So that's good.
Everything takes longer than you think, right?
Yeah, totally.
These parks, it's like, oh, we can infill, you know, 20 homes a year here. And the reality is you get three.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, we're way behind now.
Yeah. You got to have like, you know, the manpower to be able to handle that type of stuff. And it's,
and we've heard enough horror stories on development to know to kind of stay away from that.
Same. Yeah. There's been some other people on the show that just, you know, the timelines, like you were saying, they're just always twice as long as you think they're going to be. So I'm not that brave, you know, I'd rather just stick to cleaning up the existing parks. Any other, you know, mistakes, you know, due diligence or anything that comes to mind that, you know, you think would really help a, you know, a first time mobile home park buyer or operator?
Yeah. I mean, we've definitely made some mistakes. I would say like, get all your reports done, right? Like have a phase one, probably a good idea to have a survey, probably a good idea to have a zoning report. Now you're going to spend a little bit more up front, but you're going to know everything up front. Yeah. And if anything ever goes south, especially if you're taking on investors, you can kind of point to these reports that kind of protect you a little bit, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and we haven't always done that. I mean, we do it now, but we hadn't always done that. So I would say that's a big learning. Like, I know one park we own right now, it's like 2 years later after we bought it, we realized there was a, not an environmental issue, but an environmental testing well on there that like, mm-hmm. we had no idea, right? And if we just would have done a phase one, it would, you know, we would have discovered that. So just, you know, being intense on your due diligence and the reports, I think has been a big learning lesson.
Yeah. Pay attention to code. We like learn the hard way in a specific park. Your roof load has to be like 40 pounds versus standard 30. After we had already brought a home in to sell. So yeah, looking at, you know, all the details as far as setback and replacement of like for like homes. And, you know, if you're in a place that gets a decent amount of snow, looking at roof loads and all those things.
That's good. Yeah. And you would think that the manufacturer would be, you know, hey, where's this home going to go? You know, you got to meet the roof load. So it shouldn't just all be on your plate.
Yeah.
But yeah, good to make sure you're aware of that. Interesting. Okay. Well, I'll open this one up to you. If you were looking to passively invest, we'll start with you, Patrick. If you were going to like passively invest yourself into a mobile home park deal or a fund, you know, what are the most important things you would look for to try and ensure success?
Yeah. I mean, I think the first one, I would just look at their track record, the operational track record. Like, have they owned before? Or are they an apartment syndicator that's now getting into manufactured housing, right? I think you want to see some track record or success in manufactured housing. If you're going to invest with them, I would ask them kind of how they manage parks. I think most of us in the industry are vertically integrated, but I think there's some that kind of outsource some of their management. And if you're doing a turnaround park, you know, management companies are just never going to give you the same amount of detail to attention that you might do yourself. So wondering if they manage or not themselves, I think is huge. And then, you know, in today's world, I'd look at the states that they're investing. Like you mentioned earlier, like the West Coast is tough to invest in now. And I think there's some legitimate legislation risk investing out here. And so I would just, I know that's not maybe good for us, and I'm kind of shooting myself in the foot here, but I would definitely look into that too in certain states.
Yeah, that's good insight there. Nick, how about yourself?
Taking a close look at the business plan, you know, if that operator, hopefully they do have experience, but if it's maybe not to the level that you like, making sure that business plan is attainable. You know, how many homes are they looking to infill a year? How high and how quickly are they raising rents? Divesting of park-owned homes, you know, all these things that get you to that stabilized 3 to 5 year plan and making sure that it is attainable. So ask yourself those questions and what risk can pop up to kind of slow that process down.
That's a good point. You know, I'm curious, what do you guys think, you know, in a turnaround project are like the biggest risks? You know, like is a big infill project a lot more risk because of the execution risk? Is you know, park owned home conversions, that probably adds some risk, right? Because of that turnover and unexpected, you know, unexpected move outs. You know, what other things would you say are like, you know, bigger risks that, you know, passive investors should be aware of?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the two scenarios you just talked about, divesting a park-owned home and infill, making sure that the operator has either raised or has enough capital to make those projects happen, right? The last thing you want is to infill and move in 10 homes, and all of a sudden you're not selling, you're moving to a rental model, which is going to delay the sale of those homes. Maybe you can do a rent to own or convert them to owners in a year, but you've used up a healthy dose of your capital doing that. And so just making sure that you have the right amount of dollars to do those strategies, I think is very important in that scenario.
Between those two, if you feel good about the market between those two, I think that infilling is a much higher risk than divesting of park-owned homes. Because at the end of the day, you can continue to rent and, you know, selling, you know, again, as long as, you know, the home's in decent shape, it's 3-bedroom, the park looks good, you can sell, you know, your $20,000 to $60,000 homes much easier and more creatively than you can bringing in a new home and having to need to sell to 90 to 100,000. And you can do so much quicker. So between those two, we definitely prefer the divesting of park-owned homes to infill. And we know that it's an infill project, we're going to be pretty conservative on how many we do a year.
That's good. Yeah. And I think one thing that just came to me is like, things cost different prices, different locations, right? So the cost for infill for you guys may be 50, 60, crazy. 70 crazy. Grand, right? The cost for my portfolio, which is mostly Midwest based, we usually budget like 25 grand for like a used home, you know, from like a dealer. So I think just being aware of that too, right? Like, do you guys do any infill with used homes or just only new?
No, I was just saying, you're lucky you get to do that. Yeah, most of our infill is all new. We don't really have, the Pacific Northwest is weird. Like, we don't have a bunch of like Lonnie dealers or anything out here. It's kind of a different world. So most of it's been new.
We've done some of it in the past and it went okay. And that might be stretching it a bit, where we brought in used homes. There's a mobile home mover actually that just had access to these homes that people were replacing. And we brought them in, and then you quickly realize, oh, the siding is rotten and all these things need to be done. And before you know it, now you're flipping a home that you've brought in and you're into it just as much as you're going to sell it for. And you're into it 40, 50,000 when you're looking at yourself saying, I just as easily could have brought a new home. And so, yeah, we quickly moved away from that model. And then it's just access, like Patrick said, access to inventory. You just don't see a lot of good used homes floating around out here in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But no, I think to circle back, Patrick, making sure that the operator has enough capital going in to execute the business plan is so huge. I've seen time and time again, operators try to just say, oh, we're going to fund this off of cash flow. You know, we're going to use the first few years of cash flow to get XYZ done. And that's just trying to hit a moving target. You know, would you guys agree?
Yeah. I would almost side on raising or allocating more capital to, you know, park owned homes and infill than you think. You know, double whatever budget you have, just double it.
Yeah. Twice as long.
Yeah, it's definitely difficult. Nick, what do you think is the biggest threat to mobile home park investing right now?
I mean, with us, that's pretty easy. It's legislation around rent control. We're seeing some pretty crazy things being proposed right now on the West Coast. You've already seen it in California, where it's really threatening the existence of manufactured housing in the future. When you can only raise rents at CPI or 1 or 2% a year, I don't have to get into it, but as you know, there's so many items that come with that just they'll fail to exist. So without a doubt, that's in our environment, in our neck of the woods, that's the biggest risk.
Yeah. Patrick, you know, how about yourself? You know, other than legislation, other than like regulation, is there any other risks or threats that you see?
I mean, I think, you know, if you're in bigger MSAs, the threat of redevelopment of parks, I think is out there. I think that's becoming less and less as people realize that the returns on these parks are worth keeping them. I think if the United States as a whole can loosen up regulation, maybe be more similar to Texas in terms of developing parks. But if we don't, I think the supply is just going to continue to go down, and that's not good for anybody. So
exactly. Yeah. And I think, you know, like adding more supply is a better avenue for kind of like getting more affordable housing available instead of, you know, implementing rent control, you know, just time and time again. And
we've been telling our representatives that, hey, if you want affordable housing, like we have a bunch of lots you can move homes into and we'll definitely make them affordable housing, right? Like that seems a better alternative than, you know, capping a mobile home park at 7% is pretty impactful versus a downtown Seattle condo that's $4,000 a month. Like 7% on $4,000 is like probably more than enough, but 7% on $500 is just really not enough to kind of keep up with the expenses of running these.
Totally. Insurance, taxes, everything. Everything's going up. So totally agree with you. Well, this was awesome, guys. You know, I really appreciated, you know, learning about your story. If any of our listeners would like to get a hold of you or check out CMG Parks, what's the best way for them to do so?
Yeah. So we have a website, cmgparks.com. You can go in there. You can snoop on our portfolio, but you can also, there's a couple links to sign up for like our investor portal. We do still do like retail investing from time to time. And we also do co-GP opportunities. So if retail investors want to participate on our side, we do that too. So that's the best place.
At cmgparks.com, investor portal at the top right. And then if you ever want to reach out to us directly, nick@cmgparks.com or patrick@cmgparks.com.
Cool. And I'll put that in the show notes so you can find them there. What's one last bit of important advice you would give an interested passive mobile home park investor before we sign off, guys?
Just do it or just invest.
Yeah. Yeah. Pull the trigger. I mean, you'll hear it in all kinds of podcasts. You won't know until you get that first one, but you can only listen to so many podcasts and read so much. This scene, you know, once you get that first one yourself, then you'll figure things out. It's not too difficult.
Awesome. Cool. Well, thanks so much again, guys, for coming on the show.
Yeah.
You appreciate it. Thanks for having us.
That's it for today, folks. Reminder, please leave a review if you got value out of this show. Thank you so much for tuning in.
Would you like to see mobile home park value add projects in progress? If so, follow us on Instagram @passivemhpinvesting for photos and awesome videos from our recent mobile home park acquisitions. Once again, that's @passivemhpinvesting on Instagram. See you there.